From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe, Past and Present. I'm Holly Case of the History Department at Cornell, and occasionally we invite visitors to our campus to present their work on East Central Europe, Russia, or the former Soviet Union, and to interact with students. This blog series brings you their views on the past, present, and future of the region and how scholars approach it. Today I'm speaking with historian Nikolai Kopasov. Is that how you pronounce it?
Kopasov.
Now research director at the Helsinki Collegium for Advanced Studies located in Finland. From 1998 to 2009, he was dean of the Smolny College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at St. Petersburg State University. And although most of his work has been on early modern France and approaches to history more generally, with publications on a wide range of topics in French and Russian, he has recently taken interest in the politics of historical memory in Russia as well. So I'm glad that you're here. And so you studied and taught history in the Soviet Union starting in the late 1970s, is that right?
So yes, starting from 1978.
1978, that's when you started your studies.
No, that's when I became professor.
Okay, but you, and so you studied immediately before
I
that?
I started from 72 to 77, mm-hmm. and then I was immediately recruited, even before I defended my dissertation, to my department, and I started to teach, and then I defended this dissertation something like 3 years later.
Okay.
Russia was a different system from the American one, so we could do it quicker.
Okay, so in 1972 is when you began your studies. Could you tell us something about your experiences of the time? What were the contours of the historical profession then in the Soviet Union? And what historical or methodological concerns were on the minds of you and your peers?
Okay.
Yes.
Well, it's a broad question. History was not thought as something very important. Although the legitimacy of the regime was largely based on history, but still in public opinion and intellectual circles, history was not a matter of primary interest. The spirit of the age, of the decade, was dominated by structuralism, and everything which had something to do with semiology, Moscow Tartu School of Semiotics, things like that, meaning mythology, history of religion, philology, special classical philology, anthropologically treated history of literature, of ancient literature, and so on. These kind of things were in the center of interest. However, parts of history also had to do with that, especially ancient history and medieval history, but here with some reservations, because there were historians who were deeply involved in this interdisciplinary cultural studies project, but there were also others who treated those cultural issues from above and thought that real things was just history of class struggle, or just international relations, or at best economic history. And those people formed the majority of the profession, though the not very interesting majority. Things, most interesting things that were happening precisely in this interdisciplinary field of cultural studies. And as far as history was concerned, medieval history was really a vanguard here, head by a person whom you certainly know, Aron Gurevich, and Yuri Besmertny as his Engels. These were really brilliant people, very open, but marginalized in the profession, marginalized in the sense that most interesting things were marginal in the Soviet Union. I somehow got connected to this group, though the group was in Moscow and I made my studies in St. Petersburg. I would not still characterize, you know, the core of the profession, the mainstream, is completely uninteresting. There were very banal and very superficial things, but still there were, even within the mainstream, People who knew foreign languages were very attentive, you know, as far as critique of historical sources was concerned, especially as far as critique of historical sources was concerned. And I would say that one of the most interesting development of the late Soviet historiography was something that by that time was sometimes called as, how should I translate it into English? Jugendstil in the critique of historical sources. You see what I mean? Yeah? Something art nouveau of the historical method. Basically, the idea was that a historical source not only conveys information about something which is behind it, but is a part of history. And being studied as a part of history, it can tell us more about history than the information that it convey about other things. Mm-hmm. And within this, you know, research program, some of the most interesting research has been done on Russian history, basically 16th, 17th century, but also on medieval studies in France. So it was more or less authentic Russian thing, not very strongly influenced by any foreign influence. For the rest, École des Annales was certainly the prevailing intellectual influence coming from abroad, but very many people were not interested in any kind of methodology, because the only methodology that they could be using without, you know, risking the danger of having problems, was Marxism. And it was so obvious that Marxism was really Marxism was a dangerous thing to use. If you start to use it creatively, you risk to get into troubles even more than if you use Fernand Braudel or Marc Bloch. So basically it was what I call ideology of professionalism, that only facts matter, and that all kind of theories, whether Marxist or not Marxist, are just rubbish. And this was a kind of compromise between the old and already, you know, just quite vegetarian regime on the one hand, and the intellectuals who learned their lessons under Comrade Stalin and didn't want to get in troubles any longer. So the regime allowed them to do their job, but not to intervene in any kind of mythological or philosophical or political debates, and they were happy with that, we can understand it. Although by that time, personally, I was very angry with this position. Now that I get older, well, I am perhaps, well, capable to understand it. That was the landscape, basically.
Okay. Great, thank you. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your own personal path to the study of history. Like, how did you come to be a historian, and what were you looking for in history?
Well, somehow it is a very banal case. I got interested in medieval history at the age of something like 10 or 12, thanks to Walter Scott, Dumas, and whomever. I could read, and Hans Delbruck, by the way, a very distinguished German historian of war. So I entered the history department. I never hesitated, and I finished by becoming precisely a professor of the division of medieval studies. That's what I wanted to be, though I must say that medieval studies in Russia, in Soviet Russia, chronologically, used to go up to mid-17th century, because in the former times, Comrade Stalin said that the beginning of the new times, well, certainly it must have been a revolution, yeah? It was just English Revolution. So that is why Middle Ages and Soviet historiography lasted till the mid-17th century. So that was the period I always wanted to study, nothing very interesting about that. However, but something which can be more interesting is that my first choice was Byzantine history. And the choice was made not because I was interested in Byzantium, but because the most interesting professor in my division was teaching Byzantine history, so I want to work with him. And I'm happy that I did, because he was really a very good teacher, although later I realized that his political and ideological positions were not exactly what I expected them to be. But it came later, and when I was a student, his name was Georgi Kurbatov, and he was really taking care of me in a way I would only wish everybody to be taken care of. But the problem was that working with him I was happy, but working on Byzantine history I was not happy. And this was typical not only for me. A very similar story was told by Aaron Gurevich himself, when by just a matter of circumstances, basically, he was invited to the first position he could get was position Byzantine history. And he got it, and he became very unhappy for the same reason as I, because it was too similar to what we saw around ourselves. He in the late 40s, I in the 70s, but still, by the end, one had to really love Russia, you know, with all its drawbacks and problems, just which was not my case. I was always a Western-oriented person. So, and by the end, was too much of a burden for me, so as soon as I could, I switched to what I wanted to be doing, French history, or anyway, West European history. And my first dissertation was about the perception of Byzantine history in French historiography of the 17th century. So like that I came to the history of French political thought of the absolutist period, and then, because at that point I started to read French historiography and the École des Annales, I was really strongly attracted by social history. Because in Russia nothing like that existed. In Russia what existed was what was called socio-economic history. It was also, by the way, the French term, but the content behind was completely different. Russian socio-economic history was a history of classes and classes formation. So economic history was studied only in so far as the formation of classes had to be demonstrated, and social history only so far as economic criteria were in work in the formation of the social structure. And that was not certainly something very fascinating. To the contrary, what I really liked a lot in the traditional French social history of the 60s and 70s was that they were studying social structure in very multifaceted way. So they were studying various social criteria, and the problems of how these criteria work together became very fascinating for me. Basically, a considerable part of my intellectual career was about just studying from different approach, different angles, this problem. So that's it.
In terms of your interest in social history in particular, did you see social history as addressing particular contemporary concerns? Was it a political choice on your part to turn to social history? And do you see it as such in retrospect, or was it an intellectual choice that you didn't consider as having political connotations?
Well, it's a very good question, and I'm glad to be able to answer it. By that time, in Russia, social history meant something very different from what it used to mean in the same period in the Anglo-Saxon world or in France. In France or in the United States, it meant, to the best of my knowledge, a kind of liberating project. And young people who were partly from the working class origins or partly they wanted to somehow demonstrate their compassion towards suppressed people and so on, they became social historians in the 60s and 70s. In Russia, all kind of sympathy towards the working class in the intellectual circles was excluded from the very beginning, because official ideology praised working class as the privileged group of the society, and intellectuals felt themselves in reality much above the working class, but put somewhere, you know, the margins of the society by the social politics of the government. So the resentment towards the working class was very strong. So no kind of compassion towards, and it is one of the problems we experience until now. The fact that social history in Russia have not cultivated this compassion to just ordinary people is one of the most serious intellectual problems of today's Russia, because basically no kind of social politics which would go on its own in intellectual terms as something which really self-evident things to be done, no such thing exists in Russia. Russia is a society which doesn't have compassion to poor. And part of it is due to the Soviet legacy, and speaking about how social history was perceived at that time, I just would say that it was precisely part of this big story. Now, was it for me a political choice? In a sense, it was, but again in a very different sense. It was a choice because official historiography wanted to have socio-economic history or socio-political history. It didn't want to have cultural history. Instead, it wanted history of political ideas interpreted as a reflection of class struggle. And it didn't want social history. So those who were trying to do social history as autonomous history or cultural history as autonomous history were undermining the official conception of history based on the idea of the class struggle as the, I don't know, just key theme of history. So that is why partly it was certainly a political choice, but partly it was an intellectual choice, because I was really fascinated by how to intellectually relate several social stratifications between them.
Yeah, you mentioned in connection with your earlier mentor, who is the Byzantine historian, that his politics turned out to be not what you expected. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how people's politics either changed or appeared to change as a result of the events that of the 1970s, 80s, and then later the 90s, and whether you could talk a bit about, in that context, your own sense of what your politics were over that time period.
Okay, in connection to that, let me tell you not only about the person whom I already mentioned, but about one or two other persons as well. My own scientific director, how do you call it, advisor, whom I mentioned, Professor Kurbatov, and I'm really sorry to be obliged to say that, he turned out to be an anti-Semite. I really realized it a little bit too late. And he was not, you know, biologically anti-Semite as many other people are. He simply used anti-Semitism as a means of advancement of his career. So, in order to somehow become the director of the department, he had to just make a war against a group of historians who were Jews and who were previously more or less controlling this department, and he was strongly supported by the party organization of the university in that. I really did not realize all that until the day when I gave my resignation from my position at the university in 1990. This very day, somehow a man who perhaps did not want to talk to me about that, who belonged to the milieu, he told me the story of the department. It was just a late revelation, not very pleasant indeed. Given that personally I was grateful, and I'm still grateful to this professor for taking care of myself. Mm-hmm. Well, it is one story. Another story is that of my former dean at the history department of the St. Petersburg Leningrad State University, Professor Frayanov. It was a rare animal. A historian of ancient Russia, of Russian feudalism, he came up with an extremely iconoclastic conception of Russian feudalism, basically denying the existence of feudalism in Kiev, Russia, And it was one of the major challenges to the official ideology and official conception of history in the late Soviet period. Somehow I had strong sympathy with him. Later he turned a hardline nationalist, almost fascist, almost communist. You know, this combination, half fascist, half communist, half nationalist, became very typical for the late perestroika period and just for the years 1990s. Again, was very characteristic figure of the time. He was, almost a sacrilege to say this, but he was a small little Fernand Braudel. He was just in the same way an absolute monarch of the historical profession in St. Petersburg State, as Braudel was an absolute monarch in École de Haute Etude en Sciences Sociales. And certainly in Russia, monarchs are more despotic, more cruel. So you can imagine what kind of creature he was. Again, in the 1980s, many people, including myself, thought he was from the ours, from those who protested against the official ideology. Mm-hmm. But it turned out that he protested from an absolutely different side. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, the fact that the opposition to the, it was not really opposition because it was not organized. It was just a spirit of opposition to official ideology. It was really very, very broad phenomenon, but people didn't realize that within this range, there was a huge range of various positions. It became really apparent in the perestroika period. Before, in some cases certainly, yes, but only in some cases, not on the large scale. And the third person who exemplifies a little bit, you know, these political choices, was another professor of mine. His name was Revonenkov. He taught history of French Revolution. Again, it was a challenge to the official conception, because the official conception was that Jacobins were proto-communists. And he was trying to prove that Babeuf was perhaps a proto-communist, but not certainly Robespierre. Robespierre was a radical bourgeois. And it was something that the regime could not again tolerate. There were clashes between him and his Moscow colleagues, and all of us certainly were supporting our local hero struggle against the dominant ideology. We did not realize again that it was, you know, basically what was behind was the idea to return back to authentic Lenin, to authentic Marx. And again, when perestroika occurred, this person, quite elder by that time already, turned out to become just an parole of communist survival. So this is to say that the political experience of the 70s and the early 80s and the political experience of the late 80s and further on were quite different things. Before, there was a broad spirit of everybody who says something which Moscow is not willing to listen to is like we. Well, again, I exaggerate a little bit. Certainly there were people about whom we knew that they were anti-Semites, that they were Russian nationalists. There were people who were known to be that. But like Gumilev or Shafarevich or whomever, this group, Memory, this was quasi-fascist group among Russian intellectuals, patriotic mind Russian intellectuals in the 1970s. But those people, everybody knew whom they were. But within the academy, where political positions are not so visible, things were different. Well, about myself, I was more or less always trying to somehow, I wasn't always democratic-minded person. I was always Western-minded person. I always had profound disdain towards all kinds of patriotism, Russian patriotism, and things like that. Like I am now, I was more or less at that time as well. However, that's true that the degree to which somehow we had my friends and myself a capacity to reflect upon what does it entail, where does it come from, and so on, was a little less, a more limited one that I hope we have now. Mm-hmm. Somehow many of our ideas of Soviet power and so on were a little bit, you know, we never liked Soviet power, but somehow the climate of the 1960s, of the improvement of socialism, was not without influence on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And nobody certainly could foresee the collapse of communism. So we were all preparing ourselves to live until our death under communist regime, and our ambition didn't go further than to make it better. Mm-hmm. More liberal, more open to the West. Nobody, or very few people, dared to go in open struggle with the regime, and very few people had hopes that it will disappear.
So how did, let's say, to what extent was this kind of position worked out? I mean, was it something that you talked about with your friends or members of your generation, or was it through your discussions about history that you came to articulate a particular alternative, or did you see your work in history as being a kind of proxy for that? Or, you know, how did you talk about these things with other people, or how much were they part of a common understanding of the way things were or the way they should be?
Again, it's a very good question. The degree to which we were open with each other was certainly different one depending on the person. There were people with whom I was quite open. This didn't mean that we agreed upon everything. Sometimes we had hours and hours long discussions about all that. There were people with whom we didn't dare to talk more openly, but still with whom we had a feeling of perhaps somewhat shared positions, and the way to feel how other people feel about just something political, was to tell jokes. Russian anecdotes, by that time, now they are reappearing. By that time, it was really part of everyday culture, everyday conversation, and just joking about, mocking at more or less everything. It was an extremely widespread position. But within the group with whom you can have jokes, there were different degrees of openness. But there were also people who it was better not to talk openly at all. You risk to be denounced, and very often those people were known.
So when you look back on those times now, like the 70s, the 80s in particular, let's say before the collapse of the Soviet Union and the disbandment of the Soviet regime, I was wondering, how do you see that time period now? Do you look back on it with a kind of nostalgia? Or, I mean, if you had to think about how you felt then versus how you see that period now, at the time, did you feel that they were hopeful times or frightening times? Or, you know, and now, how has your view of those times changed, perhaps?
Well, I would like to answer certainly this question too, but then I would like, if I may, to return back to one of your previous questions, because somehow I have realized I didn't know that you will be asking about just the former times, and somehow I missed to tell you about two more people whom I really would like to talk to you about, because they were quite different race of people and they were really brilliant and really influential. But let me first answer this question. No nostalgia, certainly. This doesn't mean that other people do not have one. You might know that nostalgia, not only in Russia but in many post-Soviet, post-communist countries, has become typical already in the 1990s, and nowadays it is still quite a widespread phenomenon. At that time, I was afraid of Soviet power. I never felt it was my power. I preferred not to have problems with it. However, spontaneously, I tended to go a little bit further than the limit where might have been sure that there would be no problems. Not that far, but still. And from this point of view, I was always perceived as somebody who was not very reliable. And that was a distribution of roles which was clear to everybody. Who is reliable politically, doesn't matter what they think in their heads. What matters is how they will behave themselves. And there are people who are not very reliable. So I belong to those who are not very reliable. And certainly the feeling of certain degree of conflict with the power existed. Not very strong, I must confess. I never participated in dissidence activity. Very few people did. And again, as I said, we were preparing ourselves for living under communists till the end of our lives. So it was clear that compromises would be made. How do I see this period now? Well, it's good that it is over. It's good that it is over. There were good things about the times. Soviet system of education was not as disastrous as one could see, could think. There were good teachers, I said, but basically it was just a decline, and we felt that something worth going to change, we didn't expect it to change so radically and so quickly.
Maybe we could talk then about, you definitely need to go back to those two people. Yeah. But I want to ask just a follow-up question about, you know, Perestroika and Glasnost and that time period of Gorbachev, and whether, you said that you weren't anticipating the end of communism. What was it like when it actually happened?
Well, the prevailing, I guess, mood among Russian intellectuals can be expressed by a joke. A joke was about the previous perestroika under Khrushchev, when at some point there happened a huge conference about the past, when several people dared to speak up very openly about Stalin and whatever, and there was an old academician going around the room, and people pretended it was true, and said, "Listen, kids, don't speak up. They are catching up the last fools." So our perception of the perestroika period was very, very much like that. And I would say that I didn't trust either Gorbachev or Yeltsin before the putsch of 1991. We had certain aspirations.
Hopes,
I'm sorry. We had certain hopes, but and the atmosphere of freedom was quicker to come. But our expectation was that there will be a putsch, and everything will finish. When the putsch failed, this was a true, you know, revelation. This was something which, when Russian generals, Russian army and KGB didn't manage to suppress, destroy just a peaceful manifestation, basically, of several hundred thousands of people. This nobody could expect, or very few people. So the year of freedom was important. For me, it was certainly a very liberating period, not only because we could now speak more openly about the past and so on and so forth, but because very many identities and very many intellectual strategies which were ours before that came to be problematized. For example, what I have referred to as ideology of professionalism. It's kind of tacit compromise with power. It was largely my position as well. Not exactly, but largely mine, because when you can't really experiment with bold theories, the better you can do is just to go and study your sources in more or less, you know, intelligent way, as there are different ways of doing archival research, for example, right? But I think I felt that this was a compromise, and this was a compromise which I was not very happy with. So as soon as Perestroika started, somehow I became more conscious about that. And I started to speak publicly about that. And insofar as I had some cases when I intervened into public debates in the Perestroika period, I intervened precisely on this point, talking about the compromises, intellectual compromises with power, which were made by the intellectual profession, by the historical profession, and calling for a review of those intellectual strategies, which were somehow parts of these compromises. From this period on, I just took interest in Russian historical consciousness, and basically my first article about Russian historical consciousness was published in 1991 already. And I started to study Soviet historiography and then post-Soviet historiography within the context of changing public attitudes towards history, and precisely trying to examine what kinds of intellectual compromises started to, at some point, to block the development of Soviet historiography. That was my first, attempt to go beyond my narrow professional interests, and it was 100% perestroika, I think. But I must say that, it's not that I'm trying to somehow be too self-congratulatory. It was a quite exceptional reaction, because most of the colleagues, even they were willing to get involved in politics, they somehow were not so much willing to re-examine the intellectual certainties. Mm-hmm. So from this point of view, my position was minoritarian.
So maybe I'd like to transition now to the transition period, to the 1990s and after, and maybe you could talk about what your own hopes and what your own and what your generations, let's say the like-minded people, what your hopes were for something like St. Petersburg State, or how that project came to be and how your role in it was defined.
Well, there was a transition period in that, because by the end of the 1980s, I was so sure that nothing will happen, nothing good will happen in Russia, that my wife and I, we decided to take the first opportunity to go abroad with ambition to stay there. First, I got a scholarship in France. It was not my first visit to France, but the first time I went there in the beginning of the 1980s, it was still just Soviet period, but then when the 1990, and when then my scholarship was over, we took the first job that we were offered in Britain, and it was working on a sociological project related to Soviet Russia, and we went to Britain several weeks before the August putsch, so they lived the putsch through there. It was quite an experience, a very marking experience. And then again, I got another contract in France, this time for several years, and I came back to Paris as director of the Etudes Associées à l'OHSS. And it was a very, very important period of my intellectual formation. Very many things that were happening there, the decay of the Annales school, the disintegration of the macro-social, macro-historical paradigms, the attempt to build a new pragmatic paradigm, the various reactions to linguistic turn, to cultural turn, l'américaine, and so on. All this was just tremendously interesting for me. In my own research project, which resulted in the book which just which I was talking another day, it was certainly generated by that time. And then in 95, again the climate changed, and at that time we had the feeling that Russia was a country of open possibilities, and we somehow didn't want to miss our chance to be part of this transition. And we returned back to Russia in 95, having many projects in our minds, but some of them didn't succeed, but one of them finally succeeded, and it was a project of Smolny College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, which was a joint venture on St. Petersburg State University and Bard College from New York State. And I became its first dean, and it was quite an experience of trying to adjust the American liberal arts model, which we became really strong admirers, to Russian pedagogical and social traditions, which did not favor this, you know, educational philosophy at all. But to some extent we succeeded to do that. It was intellectual and political and social extremely interesting enterprise. I'm happy to have been a part of that.
Could you tell us something about how you see the fate of St. Petersburg State over time? I mean, because you are no longer affiliated with it at all, or do you maintain some affiliation?
No, I'm no longer affiliated with St. Petersburg State at all. Just a year ago we moved to Helsinki without really having ambitions to return back to Russia, because I don't think that under the current regime anything good can happen there intellectually and in other respects as well, but I'm mostly concerned certainly with intellectual issues. I don't think that reforming Russian education is at this point a practical, meaningful thing, although I'm working myself on various projects and still working, and I have worked out, for example, a project of reform of history education in Russia. I don't feel that there can be sufficient degree of social and political and financial support for any kind of reform. I think Putin's Russia to be an extremely conservative society, a society which lives from the Soviet legacy with something good, because there was not everything was bad, but mostly bad or outdated things. It is a parasitic economy which didn't manage to use its exceptional chance of the very high oil prices to reform structures or whatever it might be, either economy or society or something which I am more knowledgeable about, education, because no serious structural reforms of Russian education took place. There were ideas on the table, there were people who were willing to realize these ideas, and there were money available for that at a certain point, but unfortunately these social system works in a way that money are disappearing God knows where. Well, everybody knows, but God knows better than we. And basically, it is a society, it's a new period of stagnation. There was a moment when President Medvedev tried, I don't know whether it was a real sincere, serious attempt, or it was just a theater show, but anyway, had a feeling that President Medvedev was trying to come up with a program of modernization. It doesn't look like that any longer. That it is a serious alternative to the way the things are going on, are being done now. So my feelings about Russia are basically as follows. I don't think that anything really awful will happen there. I don't think that we are going to have a kind of new period of Stalinist terror. I really don't believe that. Nobody can exclude, certainly, but I do not believe it. But on the other hand, I think that there will be a long period of stagnation, and the more stagnation goes on, the more the regime will be at the same time lazy and oppressive. So, like that.
So maybe you could just talk a bit about what concretely you saw happening to St. Petersburg State from the time you started until 2009.
Okay, and there was a period when St. Petersburg State was, as the whole educational system in Russia, was trying to somehow adjust to the situation of extreme lack of resources in the early 1990s. That was the period that I passed in Paris, and I really don't know how did people survive this period in Russia, because nothing was really available. Then, gradually, money started to come from all kinds of sources, and starting from mid-1990s, the universities, including St. Petersburg State, started somehow to launch new programs, more or less market-oriented and so on, and it was a way of mobilizing the energy, and it was a way of somehow undermining many of the traditional certainties and evidences, you know, and basically going forward. The problem is that those people who were leading this process were sometimes more or less skillful managers, though skillful others. But they certainly had no idea about either strategically important social, you know, or cultural, you know, investments, or about what research is about. They were just, well, it's not that even they were managers. They were a special kind of Russian merchants trying to do their business in this sphere of academia. Some of them are better than some others, but basically, and to some of them I have real respect, but basically it was certainly, again, a lost chance, and after that the Putin's regime got installed. In the beginning of the years 2000, it was still a regime which was trying to solve its problems on the top of the society, but by the middle of the decade, the Putinization started to get down up to the universities. And starting from 2005, 2006, or something like that, we all started to feel really that the weather was changing. And the Minister of Education became much more powerful and much more bureaucratic. The space for educational reform became much more narrow. However, there are places where things seem to be going much better than that, and there are some universities, but really they find themselves in very special positions, where things are going much better, like the High School of Economics in Moscow, for example. This is a university which is extremely rich, well-doing, which has developed a kind of Western corporation culture, and which has attracted very good faculty members. So there are places which have dynamism. Unfortunately, St. Petersburg State is not one of them.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time, but one of the things that I wanted to give you a chance to do is talk about those two people.
Well, basically, those two people who were a real alternative to those three whom I have described were, one, my professor of Greek and ancient culture, Zaitsev, a brilliant, you know, linguist and a kind of philosopher who had a very special and really first-class approach towards the cultural development and intellectual history of ancient Greece. He formed a lot of very good students, some of them are my friends, and I was also very much influenced by him. And he was complete opposite to all kinds of political engagements. He was manifestly politically uninterested. But it was such a strong position in itself, political position, that largely because of that, many people started to study Greek with him. It was a manifestation of, you know, just incompatibility of him and people around with the system. And another person who is still alive and from whom I got a letter an hour ago is a world-class archaeologist, Leo Klein, who by the end of the Soviet period was put into jail for, he was accused of homosexualism, and even KGB, which was behind the process, didn't manage to prove it. But still he was put to jail. Then he returned back, and until now, he's now in his 90s. He is actively working. He just wrote to me a letter saying that he has published 4 new books in this year. So unbelievable person. What extremely sharp mind and really world-class theorist in archaeology. So those people who were challenging the system in a quite different way, they are proposing intellectual standards and style of thought, which were manifestly, if you want, aesthetically incompatible with the rest, were certainly the strongest influence on most of my friends and myself.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to do this. This was incredibly interesting.
My pleasure.